Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who is a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. And his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. He has an article at Salon.com. Tea Party Radicalism is Misunderstood. Meet the Newest Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Glad to be back.
And Michael, do you believe that that it's economic illiteracy underlying the Tea Party base of the GOP who feel it's necessary to take drastic steps to shut down the government in order to get our fiscal house in order, even though the deficits they cite as their principal reason are going down at a record speed?
No, actually, I don't. I think that, to quote the 60s saying, the issue is not the issue. I think that what is presented to the public as the ostensible reason for this, concern about deficits and so on, disguises what's really going on, which is a power struggle in which the constituencies of the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party really want to fight federal influence and domination over their local healthcare markets, and particularly over their local labor forces. And this sort of goes against the looking at what they're saying to what their actual motives are. And one of the things I argue in this Salon article about what I call the newest right, the emerging conservative movement, is that you can't look at the government shutdown as though this is being carried out by one group of people, the attacks on unions being carried out by another group, and then yet another separate constituency supporting voter suppression efforts. You know, all of this is part of not a conspiracy, but a strategy by the same predominantly Southern and Southwestern conservatives. And if you put it into the context of history, particularly the history of the South and the Southwest, it's a very familiar pattern. And it's something that a lot of progressives, particularly in the North, the Northeast and the Midwest and the West Coast, don't understand very well, so it's worth going into.
So, as you said in your article, the broader strategy here is from privatizing Social Security and Medicare to disenfranchising likely Democratic voters to opposing voting rights and citizenship for illegal immigrants to chopping federal programs into 50 state programs that can be controlled by right-wing state legislatures. And I take it the last one is the key one.
Yes, that's exactly right. The basic Southern economic model for a century or longer, really since the end of Reconstruction, has been control by local elites of a docile, non-unionized, low-wage workforce. And they rent the local workers to corporations from outside of the region and to investors from outside of the region. It was Northeastern and British investors in the early 20th century. Now it's German and Japanese and South Korean car factories in states like Kentucky and Tennessee and Alabama. Now, in order for this strategy to work, the dominant white, upper-class Southern elites have to have a dependent workforce with a weak bargaining power, because, you know, that's what they're saying, say, to the German or Japanese corporations. They're saying, you know, the wages are lower here. The workers are much more dependent on their employers and much more servile because they don't have unions. And it's essentially the strategy of a third world country trying to lure foreign investment. What that means is anything which, to use a technical term, decommodifies labor, anything that increases the bargaining power of workers, particularly if it's national, undercuts the power of local economic elites. So it's perfectly rational for these Southern and Southwestern economic elites to want most decisions to, over social insurance, over health care, over retirement policy, union law, obviously, to be controlled by the state legislatures, which they dominate, rather than by the federal government, which they increasingly see themselves as losing control of.
So, Michael Lind, how does this apply then? So you mentioned the migration of Japanese and German car companies to these right-to-work southern states. One of the things that I recall when Detroit was heading for bankruptcy was that a lot of the big three auto companies were moving a lot of their plants to Canada for the simple reason that the Canadians have a healthcare system, and that what was killing the big three in Detroit was their health and pension plans. And so how does you would think that capitalists would be interested in the idea that they don't have to pay for health care if you have a viable government alternative?
Well, that's exactly right. And of course, the irony is, if you look at the German and Japanese companies that are opening up these transplants in the South, their own employees are very, very well paid, you know, and also have either some government or government-backed health insurance. You're quite right. And if you look at the migration of business to the South from not only transplants of foreign corporations, but also the sort of thing that, you know, where Rick Perry is luring businesses from California and so on to Texas, the southern and southwestern states have to have massive subsidies paid for by their own taxpayers in the form of tax abatements. They have tax subsidies that they lavish on these out-of-state corporations, and then they have to raise taxes on their own people, which tend to be, since many of these states like Texas have no state income tax, so these are largely regressive sales taxes, financing huge giveaway packages in order. So it's, you're quite right. It's not simply cheap labor, but it's also tax subsidies. But what the rest of the country has to understand is this is a model. It is a system. And there's a certain logic to what kind of federal system will support it. That the conservative Southerners want to create or want to maintain in some cases. And that's one in which it's not that you don't have government health care, for example. Like even Mitt Romney said, you can take people to the emergency room. But local elites, particularly in the, although not exclusively in the South, would rather have the county emergency room system, which they control, be the source of government health care as a last resort rather than the federal government. And what I argue in my Salon column is there's been a real change in strategy on the part of the right. They were very optimistic under Bush when they controlled all three branches of government, including the Supreme Court. Karl Rove, you know, thought that you could have this McKinley-type era of conservative republicanism, and of a governing conservatism that would dominate the federal government for decades to come. Clearly, the mentality now is much more pessimistic, with Obama being elected not just once, but reelected very impressively. They see the handwriting on the wall. And so what they're trying to do now is to restructure the system in order to preserve as much power for themselves at the state and local level from federal mandates and federal control as possible.
So how far are they prepared to go to the mat then? If you have this, I mean, we know that this current shutdown of the government is an extension of the strategy that came out of that stinging defeat in 2012 when they met at Williamsburg to lick their wounds and came up with this strategy that they would not negotiate with the White House and they would not negotiate with the Democratic Senate. And that has led to this situation. Now, of course, they've switched the whole thing and they're telling the American people we're the ones who want to negotiate when, in fact, you know, they've rebuffed the Patty Murray on the Budget Committee 18 times. They simply, you know, have...
Well, there's an assumption among the media commentariat that the history of the 1990s with Gingrich versus Clinton will replay itself and the Republicans will be so unpopular as a result of this that they won't do it again, you know, for another 10 or 15 years. I'm not at all convinced of that, and particularly the Democrats have already caved once, right, by agreeing to sequester-level spending.
Right.
So they already caved in once to the hostage takers this time. If Obama, as I fear he might, negotiates with them and they come up with some framework for a grand bargain to cut Social Security or reduce Medicare cost growth or something, between now and the October 17th, they will see that as a victory, right?
Well, that's probably
become a regular tactic. So they would have essentially informally amended the U.S. Constitution so that from their perspective, you pass all laws twice. Once when they pass, and then they have to be passed again whenever these debt ceiling negotiations come up.
So that would explain then the remark that was caught by off mic when Rand Paul and Senator Mitch McConnell, both of Kentucky, were talking, and I think it was Rand Paul who said, you know, it may look bad at the moment, but we're going to win this thing. Is this basically – how much is this reality and how much is it their sort of contempt for Obama? I think they think they can roll this guy, don't they?
Well, I think it's not just Obama, because remember, you had a similar constellation coalesces in the 1990s where they're trying to impeach Clinton, you know, over the Lewinsky thing. So really starting in the 1990s, you have this increasingly belligerent right that simply treats ordinary constitutional processes. They're just going to override it. You know, they didn't like the outcome of the election in 1996, so they're going to nullify it with impeachment. They lost, you know, free and fair votes in 2008 and 2012 for the presidency. So they're just going to nullify everything a president does. I don't think it's Obama in particular may drive them crazy, but if it had been somebody else, I think it's their strategy, which is if we cannot control the government as we did under Bush, we will just, at least we will block the other side, you know, from changing the status quo, which, as I point out in my article, is perfectly rational strategy from their perspective. And I think progressives are making a terrible mistake saying these are all a bunch of ignorant, insane yahoos like lemmings going off a cliff and they're irrational. Well, you know, there's instrumental rationality. Given what your interests are and what you wish to pursue, their strategy seems fairly rational to me, because at the very worst, from their perspective, they block something, right, that they don't want, which is a success. And then they may even, if they get Obama and the Democrats to negotiate, they may even change laws and policies. So it looks kind of like a win-win situation from their perspective.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed, and his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. He has an article at Salon.com, Tea Party Radicalism is Misunderstood. Meet the Newest Right. And Michael, the previous guest, Stan Greenberg, who's been doing some polling on the Tea Party and the evangelical as well as the moderate makeup of the Republican Party, and making the argument, unless you understand internal Republican politics, you don't have a clue about what's happening now. How do you see, though, the broader landscape, where I see a small or minority of right-wing zealots, if you will, capturing the entire political agenda? The left is non-existent, and the center is irrelevant because the center keeps talking about bipartisanship. And, I mean, they're living in a fool's paradise, aren't they?
I agree. And if anything, the progressives are even more pathetic than the moderate Republicans, because the progressive solution is to whine about how they wish there were more moderate Republicans, right?
Right. Whose seats are the only ones that...
Where on the left is an aggressive agenda that people are rallying behind at the mass level, where you will use all of the instruments at your disposal, whether in the executive branch, legislative branch, to ram it through over the objections of your defeated enemies? Where is that?
Yeah.
You know, the only force, as you say, I agree with you completely, the only force in American politics at the moment that knows what it wants and knows how to get it and really wants it bad is the radical right.
And you've sort of started out working for William F. Buckley, who was
Well, he'd be considered a rhino now.
Exactly. I mean, he was the epitome of what the Republican Party used to be. And I'm just curious to know, the president more or less signaled to Wall Street, asking them to weigh in to put some pressure on the Republicans. We're learning now that last week's gatherings of American Crossroads and Crossroads GPS, the Karl Rove group, apparently Rove got an earful from a lot of wealthy Republican funders that they're very unhappy about what's happening. So, I mean, it's a bit of a paradox, as you pointed out. The best hope for the Democrats and the progressives is the moderate Republicans. And, of course, those are the very seats that they're likely to pick up if they win back the House.
Well, but this shows you how weak the progressives are, because on the one hand, they complain about big money in politics, right? And then when you actually have a movement, which, yes, the Kochs fund it, but the Kochs are essentially conservatives who have money, right? They're not necessarily the voice of the capitalist class. I mean, I know a lot of people make that distinction, but there are people who are just right-wingers who have a lot of money, and they're not thinking in terms of their particular class, but of their values. You know, and then the progressives say, well, let's hope that Wall Street and the Business Roundtable, which is fighting progressives on everything else, will somehow be a moderating force and override these Tea Party voters, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just shows you that there is no grassroots force in American politics to the left of center, anything like the, you know, this force, which you shouldn't exaggerate. I mean, they are a minority.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, they're a minority of the population. You have, if you look at the hard right, it's somewhere between 25-30% of the voters, who themselves are you know, a smaller percentage of the overall population. Mm-hmm. But a mobilized 25% can, as you say, set the agenda for the entire system if all the other forces in the system are simply reacting to what they do.
And they're the ones that will actually vote, to every last one of them, and they'll make sure as few of the Democrats vote, but through voter suppression. That seems to be
the Democrats can't exploit their potential majority, even apart from the gerrymandering in the House of Representatives and so on, because the Democrats are not a united, well, the progressive movement. This is its basic problem. It tends to be an alliance of single issue movements, right? So there's LGBT rights, there's minority rights, there's the environmentalists, there's feminism, there's the anti-war movements, and there's some overlap. But essentially, these are kind of single-issue causes. And on the contrary, if you look at the right, yes, you know, there's the religious right, but it's kind of fading, and, you know, and there's some social issues like abortion, but it's overwhelmingly economics, right?
Mm-hmm.
The right wing has this 80% of or 90% of its energy, apart from the occasional, you know, anti-abortion stuff, goes to a well-defined economic agenda. And if you look to the center left, where is that well-defined economic agenda? The Democrats are divided among neoliberals who are in favor of free trade and, you know, opposed to minimum wage in some case, and, you know, traditional social Democrats, you know, who want to protect American industry and have high wage jobs. So, you know, there's a kind of a lack of consensus about what economic policy should be to the left of center, and that further weakens the progressives when you have this very well disciplined army of, even though it's a minority of the population, it's, you know, Frederick the Great defeated the great powers of Russia, even though he was outnumbered in the Seven-Year War, right? If you're disciplined and mobilized. Really what happened when the center-left lost the unions and the local political machines, it lost this kind of army. Now, if the Occupy movement had gone differently, if it had evolved into the kind of grassroots or voter organization which could put the Democrats and in the House and the Senate in fear of being primaried.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they instead eschewed politics. So just in closing, though, do you think that the October 17th, they're going to shut down the full faith and credit of the United States and destroy America as its reserve currency?
I think there's a chance, but I think there's also a chance that there will be a face-saving solution which involves further capitulations by the Democrats.
Oh, God. Well, I fear that you may be right, and I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. And his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. He has an article at Salon.com, Tea Party Radicalism is Misunderstood, Meet the Newest Right. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about why the anti-war movement is celebrating not intervening in Syria at the same time turning a blind eye to over 100,000 civilians killed and one-third of Syria's population displaced.